All right, thank you for coming. especially, you know, that, you know, I mean, I certainly would have been tired of me by now. But this is some fun, I think a fun result that's about circuit complexity and about foundations of quantum mechanics, really. And, you know, once you think to ask the questions, it is super duper easy to prove all the results. And, you know, I could just do it here. But, you know, I think there's sort of something to me that's neat about them. And so like a lot of things that I found neat over the last 5 or 6 or 7 years, this started with a question that was posed to me by Lenny Susskind. You know, he just calls me as like, I'm like the computer science consultant / repairman of the, you know, when a wormhole is broken and, you know, you need a CS person involved somehow, that, you know, I don't pretend to know much of anything about quantum gravity, about ADS-CFT, but it's been exciting to see the different fields come together, you know, as they have over the last decade. And so this is a little result I got 3 or 4 years ago. And, you know, I then spoke about it at Stanford immediately before my son was born, which I managed to fly back in time for. And then recently with my postdoc, Yossi Atiyah, we made some new observations about it. And so we're gonna finally write up a paper about it together. Okay, so so the starting point is that Lenny was interested in situations where you have a superposition of sort of macroscopically distinct states. So let's just... let's just say, you know, the simplest case, a superposition like this one, you know, for some two, you know, large, complicated orthogonal states, V and W. Okay, and you know, specifically, what he cared about was a case where V and W encode two different space-time geometries. Okay, so let's say, you know, one, you know, encodes an anti-de Sitter bulk with a black hole, and the other one is that bulk but with no black hole. Things like that. Okay, and he was interested in the question of, you know, when are we sort of justified to make a semi-classical approximation and say, well, it is for all practical purposes, it is as if we're just in one space-time or the other one, you know? And, you know, like it's true that the other one is still there, you know, in an Everettian many worlds kind of way, but we no longer have access to it, right? And so for practical purposes, you know, it is as if nature, you know, made a choice of one or the other. And of course, you know, one could ask such things, you know, much more generally than in quantum gravity, right? This is really just, you know, basic foundations of quantum mechanics. People have been having these discussions for, you know, since almost back to the discovery of quantum mechanics itself, right? When does a superposition become, you know, effectively just a classical ensemble of possibilities, right? And, you know, maybe in principle there will be some recoherence, but, you know, in practice we no longer expect to see one, right? And you know, you could try to invent some definite criterion for when branching, you know, a bit of worlds happens, or you could just say, well, it's, you know, we know it when we say it, and it's, you know, for all practical purposes. Okay, but, you know, but either way, it sounds like just, you know, just an endless, you know, philosophy discussion, you know, it maybe is not going to get anywhere. But Lenny asked a question about this that I had never seen before. Okay, and he said, well, can we formalize what we mean by sort of the two branches being, you know, macroscopically distinct or being, you know, now like too hard to interfere with each other now? And can we do it in terms of circuit complexity? Okay, so so for all sorts of reasons, you know, related to ADS-CFT and wormholes, and so, you know, Lenny and his collaborators and this It from Qubit effort have been very, very interested in the circuit complexity of quantum states, right? And so informally, if I write like C of psi, you know, where psi is some let's say n qubit state, you know, I'll just mean the number of gates in say the smallest circuit that prepares psi starting from the all zero initial state. Okay, so so another way of writing this, you know, more explicitly, would be like this, right? The sort of the smallest number of gates like, you know, these doohickeys in any quantum circuit that, you know, starts with the all zero state maps it to psi. And so there are you know, various choices that one has to make in defining such a thing that won't matter too much for us. But you know, there's a choice of gate set. You know, we'll just fix some universal set of 1 and 2 qubit gates. Okay, there's a question of what ancillas are allowed. You know, when you prepare a state psi, I'm going to say for now that ancilla qubits are fine, but you have to return them to the all zero state, okay? So you have to be environmentally friendly. You can't leave your ancillas in some garbage state. You know, I just came from Davos, so I learned all about, you know, you can't, you know, the plastic that's filling up the ocean and so forth. So yeah, psi should be tensor the all zero state, okay? You know, we can ask about like exact versus approximate circuit complexity. In fact, we were just discussing that at lunch. For most of what I'm going to say, it will be fine to imagine this as in it, you know, the circuit complexity of preparing psi exactly. But if you don't like that, you could just write little subscripts of epsilon in front of everything that I'll say, and, you know, talk about approximate preparation of the states, and, you know, pretty much everything I'll say will go through unchanged. Okay. So you know, once you've made suitable choices, what this does, it actually defines a distance metric on quantum states on the set of all n qubit pure states. So specifically, we can now talk more generally about for any two n qubit states v and w, we can talk about the relative complexity of v and w. That is the number of gates in the smallest circuit that maps V to W, right? You know, clearly, you know, there will always exist such a circuit. And in fact, you know, there will be such a circuit with at most about 2 to the n gates, you know, something like that. Okay, that's a not hard construction. And so, this will always hold. And you know, this will be symmetric. This will, you know, because I can just invert the unitary. This will equal the relative complexity of producing V given W. And it's a distance metric. It is one that is quite different from the usual metrics like trace distance, for example. Okay, and you might notice that two states could be you know, extremely far in trace distance. You know, in fact, they can be orthogonal, and yet they could have a very small relative complexity. Like one is reachable from the other by flipping a single qubit or something like that. Conversely, two states could be extremely close in trace distance. and yet extremely far in this complexity metric. For example, if one state is the all zero state and the other one is all zero plus epsilon times a Haar random state or something like that, okay? Yeah, so maybe I should mention explicitly, for almost all n qubit states, their circuit complexity will be 2 to the n, or you know, very, very close to 2 to the n. And this is easy to see by accounting argument, for example. There just are not enough small circuits to go around, you know, for more than a few states to have a lower complexity than that. Okay, but of course, the states that violate this, that have a low complexity, are of very great interest to us because those are the ones that we can actually prepare and manipulate in this world. Okay, so now what does this have to do with this question of macroscopic coherence? You know, when you have a superposition like this, you know, the question in some sense that really interests us in, you know, quantum foundations, or, you know, certainly if we were looking at things from like a many worlds point of view, right, you could say the right question to ask is there any experiment you can do that will distinguish this state from, let's just say, a mixture of V and W? Like that, right? What ends up being an equivalent question, is there an experiment you can do that will be sensitive to this phase of the superposition? So like it will distinguish V plus W over root 2 from V minus W over root 2, right? So what will it take to distinguish these? Now, of course, in principle, you know, there always is some measurement that will distinguish all of these states, okay? Even if V is an alive cat and W is a dead cat, right? Well, you know, you just have to measure in the alive plus dead and alive minus dead basis. If I always get alive plus dead, well, I guess it was this. If I always get alive minus dead, I guess it was that. If I get half and half, I guess it was this, right? So so in principle, there is an experiment, okay? But you might say that, to put it mildly, that is sort of outside of our technological abilities right now, okay? You know, I mean, we can just barely get 53 qubits to do what we want, right? And, you know, a cat is some, you know, Avogadro's number of qubits, right, that you would have to, you know, coherently manipulate if you wanted to actually be sensitive to this phase. Okay, and so and you could say that technological limitation, you know, in some sense is the thing that tells us that sort of for all practical purposes, we might as well treat Schrodinger's cat as being in this state, you know, just being in a mixture of alive and dead, right? That for any experiment, for all the experiments that we can sort of feasibly do, at least today, well, you know, those experiments will involve things like opening the box and checking if the cat is dead or alive, and those do not distinguish this state from this state from this state. Okay, but now that, you know, the question is, well, you know, in general, how do we know that? Like, how do we know that there's not a feasible experiment that could be sensitive to this phase, and it's simply one that we hadn't thought of yet? Okay, and so Lenny sent me an email a few years ago, and he said, you know, I have a specific conjecture that you know, if you could do that, if you had an experiment that was sensitive to this phase, then that would be basically equivalent to being able to do an experiment that swaps these states, that maps V to W, or that maps W to V. Okay, or so in other words, he is conjecturing that the circuit complexity of distinguishing the relative phase in a superposition like this is the same as the circuit complexity of bringing a dead cat back to life. Or, you know, mapping V to W, mapping W to V, right, of actually swapping the states. Okay, so that, you know, if you have the intuition that, you know, necromancy seems hard, right? It seems hard to bring dead cats back to life. Well, then it should be equally hard to, you know, measure the phase in a Schrodinger's cat. Okay, so now there was a question. So what was the answer to the question? Okay, So the first thing that I noticed is that in some sense this is just clearly true. Okay, you know, I never thought to phrase the question that way, but once he did, he was just completely right about this. And I can take like 3 minutes and I can show you why, exactly why. Okay. So again, you know, we have our orthogonal n qubit states, V and W. Okay, now I want to consider two different superpositions of them, you know, psi, which is V plus W, and phi, which is V minus W. And so the claim is that, you know, if I have a unitary U that can swap V and W, let's say perfectly. So if I have a unitary that maps V to W and W to V, right, just swaps the two, then this is actually equivalent, in some sense, to having a unitary that perfectly distinguishes psi from phi, right? If I have one, I can get the other, okay? Why? Well, all right, there's two directions. So first of all, if I have such a U, how do I use it to distinguish? Anyone want to help me? I'll give you a hint. You can use a control qubit.
Control U.
Yeah, right. Okay. So look, I put a control qubit in the plus state. Okay? Conditioned on the control qubit being one, I apply U. Right? Okay, and then I look back at the control qubit and I see what I got. Okay, so what happens? Well, you know, here's a state here, which is either psi or phi. Okay, if the state was psi, then nothing happens, right? I apply U, nothing happens. My control qubit's still in the plus state. Okay, if my state was phi, then I apply U, and then And now V minus W gets mapped to W minus V, okay? And now this is in the minus state, right? Okay, simple, right? So then I measure the control qubit and I've distinguished whether my state was psi or phi. Got it? Yeah.
So in your definition of the script C, you said you're not allowed to use ancillary qubits.
Oh, you're totally allowed to use them as long as the, you know, as long as you clean up after yourself.
Oh, I see. And this can be done.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And so here, yeah. So here really I just needed the controlled application of you, right? So like that. Okay? And then just a measurement of the control qubit. Okay, now what about the other direction? So supposing that I can distinguish this state from this state, then why does that mean that I can swap these two states? That might seem a little bit less obvious, but I'll show you that that's equally simple. Okay, so the point is, what does it mean to be able to distinguish this state from this state? Well, you know, ultimately it means that I have some unitary transformation, you know, so some circuit, if you like, call it A, where if I apply A to psi, then I will get zero plus, you know, some other stuff. And if I apply A to phi, then I will get one. Or some other stuff. Right. You know, it means that, you know, there is some circuit such that after applying it, there's some qubit I can measure that tells me whether I had psi or I had phi.
And other stuff can be different.
Yeah, it can be different. Okay, so, okay, but now once we have this A, okay, well, let's notice that V is just psi plus phi over root 2. W is just psi minus phi over root 2, right? So, and now, you know, my goal is just to swap this state with this one, map this to this, and vice versa. How do I do that? Anyone? I apply A, right? I apply A, and then I apply a phase conditional on the first qubit being 1, and then I apply A dagger, right? Like that. Okay, and then this maps to this, this maps to this, I'm done. Okay. All right, so that was very simple. But, you know, you might worry that, what about a more general situation? So you know, in particular, you know, what if, you know, I have a unitary transformation that, you know, let's say maybe it maps V to W, that is, it brings a dead cat back, you know, back to life. But that doesn't mean that if I apply the same unitary again to the alive cat, that it maps it back to the dead cat, right? Maybe it maps it to, you know, a super alive cat or something else, right? So, So in general, you know, the ability to map between states is not quite the same thing as the ability to swap two states, right? And so we have to be a little bit careful before asserting that the swap, you know, that the mapping and distinguishing are equivalent to each other. As a simple example, like if I have some random quantum circuit C, maybe, you know, it maps the all zero state to some complicated state, but I wouldn't expect the same circuit applied a second time to map this complicated state back to the all zero state, right? So, let me encourage you to see this as just one special case of a much more general situation, which is, suppose that I have a unitary that maps V to some state that may have some overlap with W. Okay, it maps W to some state that might or might not have some overlap with V. And then the question is, you know, if I can do that, then, like, does that also give me an ability to distinguish V plus W from V minus W, you know, or at least a partial ability, okay? And conversely, if I had a partial ability to, you know, detect the phase of on Schrodinger's cat, you know, to distinguish V plus W from V minus W, would that give me a partial ability to map V to W or vice versa? Okay, so now I can state a theorem. Deals with this scenario, you know, so it'll be more general, but fortunately this one will also be it will end up being very, very simple to state. Okay. So again, we've got two orthogonal n qubit states, V and W. And now suppose that WUV is some number A, and VUW is some other number B. Okay? So, you know, in the case of a perfect swapper, A and B were both 1, right? But they, you know, they could, in general, they could be, you know, any complex numbers, right? And of norm at most 1. Okay, then the theorem says that by using U, or let's say by using a circuit that is only, you know, slightly larger than whatever circuit we had for U, so, you know, with essentially the same circuit complexity, it is possible to distinguish V plus W from V minus W with a bias in distinguishing them of absolute value of A plus B over 2. Okay? So, and, you know, in the case where A and B were both 1, this is just 1, right? This is just perfect distinguishing. Okay? In the case where my unitary, let's say, mapped V to W and it mapped W to something totally different that was orthogonal to both V and W, well, then A is 1 and B is 0, and then this is a half. Okay, so it's saying that in that case, you know, ability to bring a dead cat back to life implies a partial ability to, you know, detect a Schrodinger cat. Okay? And then there's actually one extremely interesting case here. Anyone see it? Well, you know, what if I had a unitary that mapped a dead cat to an alive cat, but it also mapped an alive cat to minus a dead cat? Okay, so it just put a minus one phase, you know, in between the two different mappings. Well, then I get bias zero here. Okay, and so I could have that ability, and that would not imply any ability at all to detect Schrodinger cats. Okay, that is sort of the loophole in this theorem. Okay, and you might wonder if that's just like a technical artifact. I can prove that no, that we can prove that no, that that is actually inherent to this theorem.
But if you have the ability to distinguish a live cat and a dead cat, then you can fix that.
So this theorem is going from the mapping to the distinguishing. Okay, there's also there is a converse theorem as well, which does not have that loophole.
No, I mean what? That if you can distinguish an alive cat from a dead cat, you can do the same thing that you did here and switch the phase of minus dead cat.
Yes, yeah, that's right. But here we're trying to get distinguishing as the conclusion.
No, but not distinguishing the plus and minus states, distinguishing the live cat from W.
Sorry?
If you have something that distinguishes V from W,
yes,
then you can do phase
relative sure.
to V and W.
Sure. Yes. Yeah, so maybe one thing that I should stress is that the ability to distinguish psi from phi is a very, very different thing from the ability to distinguish V from W, right? And, you know, in fact, you could have either of those things without the other one, okay? So maybe some examples would help clarify that. Just a sec. Oh, right. So here's a good example. Okay, so let's say that V was the all zero state, and W was some really complicated state, you know, that maybe had 2 to the n circuit complexity, but it's orthogonal to the all zero state, right? So then, okay, first of all, you know, these states are very easy to distinguish, right? You know, I just measure and I see if it's the all zero string or not, okay? Easy to distinguish, but clearly also very hard to map V to W. You know, you got to prepare this monstrosity, okay? You know, now if we look at V plus W, V minus W, then we find that exactly the converse is true, okay? These two are very easy to map one to the other, right? I just apply a phase conditional on the string being non-zero, right? Easy to swap this state with this state, okay? But very hard to distinguish these states. Now, how do I know that it's hard to distinguish them? Anyone have a proof? All right, you want me to tell you? Well, look, by the theorem that I just showed you, the ability to distinguish these two is equivalent to the ability to map this to this. We already said that was hard. Okay? If I could distinguish these two, then I could also map V to W. Right? Okay, so the general rule is that swappability in a given basis sort of is equivalent to distinguishability in a conjugate basis. Okay, you know, those two things have the same circuit complexity. Okay, but swappability and distinguishability within the same basis, those two could be totally unrelated to each other. Okay, so now to come back to this, I can state a converse of this theorem. Okay, so now I want to consider two orthogonal states, psi and phi. And I want to suppose that I have a distinguishing procedure, A, that accepts psi with a high probability, probability 1 minus epsilon, and that accepts phi with a low probability, let's say delta. Okay? Then using A, we can map V, which is psi plus phi, to W, which is psi minus phi, with fidelity, meaning inner product, 1 minus epsilon minus delta. Okay, it's just that. And you know, in some sense, this, you know, each of these sort of establishes the tightness of the other one in a certain sense. Okay, and now the proofs of these are just you use the procedures that I already showed you. Okay, but you just keep track of the A's and B's and epsilons and deltas. Yeah.
What does A accept psi mean in this case?
Oh yeah, so it means, sorry, so I think of it as a circuit followed by measuring a qubit, you know, in the 0-1 basis to make a decision of either accept or reject. Okay, yeah.
When you say using A,
yeah,
you're keeping track of the complexity, but in one case, mm-hmm. it was like times 2 plus 1 the complexity.
Yeah. All right. So if you want to, right. So if you want to keep track of the that complexity, in this case, let's say the circuit complexity to do this mapping procedure is going to be, let's say, twice the circuit complexity of applying A, plus some lower order terms. Okay. Plus which lower order terms? You know, I mean. Certainly, it's going to be linear in the number of qubits. Okay, so and here in this one, there's not even the factor of 2, I believe. Okay,
Because you're doing controlled view, right? So you have to if you have a Cnod in U, you have to make it a Toffoli gate. So if you're starting with 2 qubit gates.
All right, fine. If we don't get controlled gates for free, then we pay a constant factor for that. Yeah, you're right.
I mean, I think to be fair, you know.
Okay. All right. I don't care about constant factors anyway. Okay. And yeah, also L over here. Okay. So the point is, you know, the two circuit complexities are linearly related to each other. Okay. The same. Okay. So you know, it is a little bit interesting that you get this absolute value of A plus B here, right? And basically, actually, what happens if you just do the calculation with the procedure that I already showed you? You know, so just the exact same procedure, and this is now like, you know, an homework exercise. You know, and anyone here could do it, right? What you'll end up with is. is this, half of the real part of A plus B. Okay, this is what you end up with. But then I say, well, look, if I wanted to optimize the bound, then I would just multiply by a global phase in order to make A plus B equal to its own real part, right? And that would give me the maximum distinguishability. Okay, but now let me come back to, you know, what looked like sort of an annoying little caveat in this equivalence that I'm asserting between you know, necromancy and Schrodinger's cat experiment, you know, between measuring the phase between the alive and dead states and swapping the alive and dead states. Okay, namely that if A equals minus B, then I might have the ability to bring back cats from the dead, but yet I would have no ability to detect the relative phase in superposed cats. Okay, and you know, so you might say, well, surely that's just some technicality, and if I came up with a better procedure, then it would solve that problem. All right, so let me show you an example that Yossi Atiyah came up with a couple of weeks ago that actually refutes that and shows that this minus one phase thing is a real issue. Is there a bigger chalk? All right, I can use this chalk, whatever. What about an eraser?
On the top.
Oh, up there? Up here?
Yeah, on the, there's the strings, yellow.
All right, I got it.
Chalk there too.
Oh yeah, there you know. Okay, good. Okay, so here's what we're gonna do. I'm gonna let eta be some really complicated quantum state of n qubits. Like let's say, you know, one with a circuit complexity of 2 to the n. Like, you know, for example, a Haar random state. Okay, and now I'm gonna consider the following two states, V and W. Okay, so V is gonna be 0 eta plus 1, the all zero string. Okay, W is gonna be I zero eta minus I one, the all zero string. Okay, so now, first claim. Is that it is easy to design a unitary transformation U that will map V to W while also mapping W to minus V. Okay, now how do I do that? Well, you know, all I have to do is I first add a global phase of I, and then I just apply a controlled phase, okay? Right, so add a global phase of I, do a controlled phase, that's gonna map V to W, and if you do the calculation, you'll check that also mapped W to V. Right, add a global phase of I, multiply through by I's, then I, you know, apply a phase, I get back up to here. Okay, but suppose that I were able to apply a unitary that mapped V to W, and that also mapped W to V with no phase, right? And you know, this seems weird because you know, like relative phase is supposed to, global phase is supposed to never matter in quantum mechanics. Well, guess what? Here it does matter. Okay, because you know what actually matters is the relative global phase between this thing and this equation and this equation. right? So suppose I was able to map V to W and W to V with no phase. Well, then let's look at what that would do when applied to the state 1 and 0 to the n. Now, I noticed that 1 and 0 to the n is just V plus IW over root 2, right? I just combine these in a way to get, you know, 1, 0 to the n. And that, because U swaps, this is W plus IV. And what is that? Well, now if I pull out an I, that is just like IV minus IW, which is I0 eta. Okay? So in other words, if I could map V to W and W to V without the minus one phase, then I would also be able to map like the all zero initial state to this crazy state eta, okay, which we know is impossible. All right, so this is why this talk was called the necromancy hardness of the Schrodinger's cat experiment, rather than the necromancy completeness of the Schrodinger's cat experiment.
Sorry, can you just summarize like the statement that you've just proven?
So the statement again is that it is possible, you know, and this is just an unconditional statement, right? It is possible to have a situation where I have two n orthogonal n qubit states, V and W, such that there is an efficient unitary that maps V to W and W to minus V. There is not an efficient unitary that maps V to W and W to V. Okay? All right, okay. So in particular, you know, it shows that, you know, by the equivalence theorem, that also means that there is not an efficient unitary to distinguish V plus W from V minus W. Okay? Even though, you know, you can actually map V to W, but because you're mapping W to minus V, it does not imply the ability to distinguish a superposition of V and W from a mixture of them. All right, so, and in fact, using constructions involving Haar random states, it is possible to prove that sort of all, you know, the theorems that I showed, you know, here are actually tight. Okay, they cannot be improved upon, right? And it's rare in circuit complexity. You know, usually when you say, oh, you prove something is optimal, you mean under such and such complexity assumptions. No, I just mean you can prove it. Okay, and the reason is that, you know, you can just use Haar random states where you just know that there's no small circuit, right? With overwhelming probability. Okay, all right, so just, you know, maybe a few last remarks. So in our definition of relative complexity, say, you know, relative complexity between the states V and W, it was really important that while we allowed ancilla qubits, you know, we required that any ancilla qubits be returned to the all zero state, or, you know, sort of cleaned up after. Did anyone notice where we used that, where we tacitly used that assumption? Well, when I was showing that distinguishability implies swappability, right? And I said, you know, we have to like apply this A, but we also have to apply A dagger, right? Well, if there was this garbage left over, some arbitrary garbage, then I would not have been able to do A dagger, right? So, you know, so it was actually important that V gets mapped only to W, or, you know, does not get mapped to like W tensor garbage.
But,
yeah.
But I mean, if you kept the garbage around, then you could still do it,
right? But there would still be, let me think. The We'll have to trace through it, right? The question is, can I assume that the garbage will be there regardless?
There's standard results that you can always clean up your garbage, right?
You can clean up garbage if the garbage is classical. If the garbage is some quantum state that your intents are product with, then in general, we don't know how to clean it up, right? And in fact, that is precisely the issue that I wanted to draw attention to here.
Well, okay, if it's deterministic, that's not true. If it's entangled with the output, maybe that's true.
Let me raise the following question. Okay, this is actually one of my favorite questions. Is there a case where is there ever a situation where I have this, where there's some state psi that I would like to prepare, and there is a small circuit that will prepare psi tensor with some crazy garbage, right? That just arises as a byproduct of my circuit to, you know, prepare psi starting from the all zero initial state. Okay, but if I just want psi itself without the garbage, then that would be much harder
to do. That's fine, but in the specific application that you did, you did A, and specifically you had the state zero tensor stuff.
Right.
Or one tensor stuff.
Right.
And those are different stuff, and the garbage can just be put into that stuff. You can do the phase shift and undo it.
Let me see. So, oh, maybe that does work. All right, so maybe this problem is not important for that. All right, I'll have to, you know, really? Okay. All right, good. I learned something.
What the new information here is?
So Daniel's saying for this specific purpose, even if my circuit were generating garbage, I could live with it because, you know, I could invert the circuit and I know what the garbage is in this case. And I think that, all right, I want to think about it offline. That seems right. Okay.
What was the answer to your federal question to ask?
Sorry? Oh, so I still don't know the answer to this question. No. I don't know any example where this happens, but I also can't rule it out. You know, but this is like, you know, it may seem like a technicality in defining the circuit complexity of a state, but, you know, if for all I know, this might actually be important somewhere. Right? Okay. Well, apparently not here. Okay, yeah. So, you know, in terms of... applications, right? So one particular implication of this sort of equivalence result might be interesting is that let's suppose that V is a simple state. So like its circuit complexity is polynomial. And let's suppose that W is a very complicated state. So, you know, its circuit complexity is exponential in N. And now I look at a superposition of the two. Okay? Now, you know, where would a situation like this arise? Well, one example is, you know, according to the reigning ideology of ADS-CFT, you know, circuit complexity is sort of like a measure of how long your, you know, CFT state has been evolving for. Like it's like an intrinsic clock, you know, maybe the almost the only, you know, independently motivated measure that anyone can think of that sort of you can, you know, use as an intrinsic clock to see like how long has this state been evolving for, right? And so the idea is, you know, in a CFT, I have some initial state psi zero, and then, you know, just some time independent Hamiltonian H gets applied, you know, potentially for a very, very long time. And, you know, and then, well, that produces some, you know, more complicated state. You know, the what excites people is that while this is sort of happening and this, you know, this just Schrodinger evolution on this conformal field theory that lives on the boundary of ADS, you know, meanwhile, what is happening in the bulk is something much more geometric, like, for example, a wormhole is getting longer and longer and longer. Okay, and so this led to this conjecture that, you know, you might have heard about in recent years. You know, it's related to ER equals EPR, or, you know, grew out of that, that says that you know, geometric things like wormhole volume are captured on the in the boundary CFT by circuit complexity. Okay, that, you know, if someone handed me this psi t and I wanted to know what was t, I wanted to solve for t, you know, then, you know, the most obvious way to do it would be, well, just kind of look at how complex the state is, right? And that'll be sort of a proxy for how long it had evolved for. Okay, and you know, so we were in work with me and Lenny Susskin, we were able to give some support for this conjecture, you know, that circuit complexity, you know, really does generically increase linearly with time, you know, as you sort of, if you take a generic kind of CFT Hamiltonian and you just let it evolve for a long time to a suitable initial state, the thing you might worry about would be that there would be some shortcut that would just let you prepare psi sub t in polynomial time, even if t was exponentially large, okay? But we can show that under suitable complexity assumptions, like, you know, P space is not in PP slash poly or whatever, you know, that you know, for a generic enough Hamiltonian and initial state, that's not gonna happen, right? The complexity will indeed, you know, continue to increase all the way until it like hits a maximum, presumably around 2 to the n. And then, you know, it'll probably just stay there for a long time. Okay? But so now, you know, so like the state after a long time is, you know, corresponds to a very long wormhole. And, you know, and this is a very complex CFT state. The initial state would correspond to a short wormhole, and that was a simple CFT state. Okay, and now the statement I want to make is that if you were to superpose those two states, okay, like the early and the late time CFT states, then there is no feasible experiment that you could do, no polynomial time experiment that will ever detect this relative phase. Okay, so if I take a simple state and an exponentially complex state and I superpose them, then there, you know, there is no experiment of sub-exponential circuit complexity that can ever, you know, just distinguish this from a mixture of the two. Okay, and how do we know that? Well, because the circuit complexity of distinguishing this phase is the same as the circuit complexity of mapping this to this, which you know, we already said is exponential. Okay, and then, you know, beyond that, I would say, you know, the implication, you know, is simply that the Schrodinger's cat experiment involves a lot less animal cruelty than is normally imagined. Okay, you know, I mean, it sounds like this incredibly, you know, macabre, right, thing to do, but you know, in fact, you know, and I think this is actually kind of a fundamental point. Right, that, you know, the kind, when you talk about either Schrodinger's cat or Wigner's friend or any of these thought experiments, the kind of abilities that you were talking about to actually detect that those are superposition states at all are the same abilities that, you know, would also let you bring a dead cat back to life. And so then you could say, well, then what did it even mean for it to be dead if you can just so easily bring it back to life anyway, right? You can just, you know, the ability to detect quantum interference is the ability to rotate between, you know, life and death. And so in such a world, you know, nothing is permanent, right? Anyway, all right, so let me stop there. So thanks for listening.
Scott?
Yeah.
Are there assumptions on the Hamiltonian for the linear?
Assumptions on the what? Say it again.
Hamiltonian.
Oh, yeah. There are. So now we're talking about my result with Lenny. But the basic assumption on the Hamiltonian that we make, and if you want to see the details, they're in my Barbados lecture notes. Actually, Lenny also has a paper where he explains it, okay? But the basic assumption on H is that sort of H is able to implement a step function of a universal computation. So, you know, in other words, that it is computationally universal. For example, because it implements one step of a computationally universal cellular automaton or something of that kind, right? Now, what's interesting is that there had been a conjecture in the, you know, quantum gravity world that, you know, the condition on H was going to be some kind of chaotic behavior, okay? So, that in other words, that whenever you had a chaotic Hamiltonian, that it would lead to, you know, enormous complexity growth. Clearly, there has to be some condition on H, right? If H is the zero Hamiltonian, it's never going to give you any complexity, right? So the conjecture was, well, as long as it's chaotic, you know, that should be sufficient. I could not exactly confirm that, okay? But, you know, I could show something related, which is that once you have computational universality and then you're acting on a suitable initial state, then yes, you are generating more and more complex states over time. Under, you know, unless P space is in PP/Pauli, whatever. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Following up on that question, so is the assumption you mentioned related to this no fast forwarding of
the Hamiltonian? Yeah. So that's, in fact, Yossi Atiyah, you know, my co-author on this, and Derrida Haranov have a paper about that where they, where they also discuss my and Lenny's thing in that paper, right? But yeah, I actually like the term that they use for this. Like, you know, they're saying, like, what are the conditions for a Hamiltonian to be fast forwardable or non-fast forwardable? That is, for there to be some efficient circuit that can just let you apply this, you know, simulate an exponential amount of time evolution of this Hamiltonian, right? Now, there are some Hamiltonians that are fast forwardable, right? And in fact, at the core of Shor's algorithm is a fast forwardable Hamiltonian. Okay, why? Because like the modular exponentiation function, right? The whole point, you know, the thing that makes Shor's algorithm work from a certain perspective is that you can efficiently fast forward that, right? Using repeated squaring. You can just get, you know, any value of the function, you know, super efficiently without having to go through all the earlier values. Okay, so, but generically, you would expect that most Hamiltonians should not be fast forwardable, right? And in some sense, my and Lenny's result says that, yes, that is correct. You know, computationally universal Hamiltonians are not, in general, fast forwardable unless P space is in PP/Pauli. Okay, so, but I would encourage you to read the paper by Derrida Haranov and Yossi Atiyah on fast forwarding. It's a beautiful paper. Okay, yeah.
So this is very nice, very pretty. It does seem that this other kind of definition, where you don't have to clean up the garbage, and where it's not kept so that you can use it to reverse, the definitions make sense. But I guess all the results just, you can't really, the whole theory.
Well, okay, like, except now I want to revisit that in light of what Daniel just, you know. There are certain things that I know break down if you have this garbage laying around, right? There are various things that I would like to do with, you know, circuit complexity of states that will definitely break down in a situation where I have this. Just, you know, the stuff from, you know, I want to go back and check whether any of the stuff that I talked about in this talk would break. You know, maybe it doesn't.
But if you're not allowed to keep the garbage, if you're really working with channels or something, I mean, that's also a kind of a reasonable definition. Because if you keep the garbage, then you're working in, it's kind of like you're working in a larger Hilbert space.
Right.
Previous model.
Yeah.
And so, well, I guess it could be explored in a case where you don't have the garbage anymore.
Yeah.
But probably it'll be hard to prove anything.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean. Oh, you don't have the garbage anymore, but yeah.
Is the condition that you have to clean up the garbage motivated by the original physics question, or is it?
Well, yeah, it's motivated by the notion of relative complexity, right? So one thing that would break is that, you know, relative complexity need not be a symmetric, you know, distance measure, right? You know, if I can have garbage.
So the definition is partly because then the results work out nicer.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, we want like a distance metric on states. And, you know, we want to map V to W and then reverse that and map W to V. And, you know, and if there's garbage around, then we lose control over some of those things.
But, I mean, if you're talking about sending dead cats to alive cats, you probably want a lack of reversibility, right? Because otherwise, sending a dead cat to a live cat is just equivalent to sending a live cat to a dead cat, which seems more reasonable.
Well, I guess if we're sending a live cat to a dead cat, we would like to be able to reverse that. If we're sending a dead cat to a live cat, we would, you know, maybe you'd like to not be able to reverse that, but that's probably too much to ask for.
I mean, the thing is, you've got one-way functions.
Right.
One way, and
yes,
according to your definition, one-way functions wouldn't exist. So everything becomes.
Well, no. Well, I mean, one-way functions. So, you know, I mean, I'm sure you know all this, right? But, you know, just to say for others, right? You can have a one-way function in a reversible world because you can map x comma zero to x comma f of x, right? And then, you know, but that doesn't imply that you can map x comma f of x to x comma zero.
Okay, but it doesn't really break the cryptography by just saying, you know, like in cryptography, you can keep the X.
Well, in classical crypto, in classical crypto, it wouldn't matter if I kept it.
If you have X comma F of X, you can map that back to X comma zero.
No, you're right. That's right. I can map X comma F of X to X comma zero. I can't map it to just
F of X.
I can't map F of X to X. Even in the case where F is injective, because if I could, then I could, invert F. It's late, sorry.
Sorry.
Okay.
Thanks, Scott, for two great talks.